the good graces of Aegir, the Norse sea deity, fond of dragging men and their ships into the depths. Just when Rhys was sure that the seas couldn't get any rougher, the storm dialed up its intensity. The craft surged upward as a flash of lightning illuminated the ocean, and for a split second Rhys was sure it wasn't the tumor that was going to kill him. He was riding directly toward the crest of a wave that towered above the boat's mast. Like a roller coaster, the vessel paused at the peak of the wave before surging downward toward the black sea below. Rhys felt weightless as he gripped the stainless steel wheel with both hands and braced for impact, screaming an animal roar at the top of his lungs. All 30,000 pounds of the bitter harvest careened into the trough in a deafening crash, Rhys's body slamming into the wheel with the force of a driver in a head-on collision, knocking him into darkness. A cold wave washing over the gunwale shocked Rhys into consciousness. He found himself lying on the deck between the steering stations, his face throbbing from its meeting with the boat's wheel. His hand instinctively went to his face and came away wet with blood that washed translucent almost instantly in the downpour. His head was gashed open, and his nose felt broken, but he was alive. The boat's keel had held. Using the wheel to pull himself to his feet, he reclaimed his place at the helm. Blood ran into his eyes. Not that he could see much anyway. He focused on keeping the compass oriented south so he would pass through the storm as quickly as possible. Things didn't improve much, but they didn't seem to get worse. He hoped that the massive wave he'd ridden was the climax of the storm. Perhaps he was just adapting, but it seemed as though the weather was easing a bit. Over the next few hours, Rhys would wipe the blood from his eyes, check the heading, adjust the rigging, and wipe the blood away again. His nose throbbed, and the open wound on his forehead stung in the salty spray of the unforgiving Atlantic winds. Chapter 2. Save Valley, Zimbabwe, Africa, August 1998. Rhys had shot a very impressive kudu bull that morning, a spiral-horned antelope known by many as the Gray Ghost due to its elusiveness. He, Rafe, and the trackers had pursued the animal since dawn, and the old bull finally made the mistake of stopping to take a peek at whatever was tracking him. Loading the nearly 600-pound animal into the bed of the small pickup had been a challenge, but between the ingenuity of the trackers and the cruiser's winch, they had made it happen. They wore the carefree smiles of youth as they approached the ranch house. Rafe drove with Gona, the junior tracker, riding shotgun, while Rhys and the senior tracker rode in the high seat, welded to the bed of the truck, sipping beers and enjoying the beautiful countryside. As they turned the corner where the house came into view, Rafe could tell instantly that something wasn't right. Three battered pickup trucks were parked haphazardly on the manicured lawn of the main house, and a group of about a dozen men were scattered around the yard, most of them visibly armed. Rafe drove straight toward the trucks and stopped just short of the crowd. Feeling very exposed in the back of the truck, Rhys eyed the group, whose demeanor was clearly hostile, and wondered what was going on. He counted the men, taking note of how many were displaying weapons, and glanced down at the .375 H&H rifle sitting horizontally in the rack that ran just in front of his knees. The math wasn't good. Rafe said something to the intruders in Shona, but they ignored him. The trackers hunched down in their seats like scolded dogs, their eyes fixed on their feet. Rhys had learned to trust their judgment over the past month and decided that eye contact with their visitors was not a good idea. Their dress ranged from soccer jerseys to threadbare dress shirts. Their only uniform seemed to be a lack of uniformity. Most appeared to be in their teens or early 20s, and the weapons they carried were a mix of AKs, shotguns, machete-like pangas, and battered old hunting rifles. Rhys had no idea who these guys were, but he could tell that they weren't happy. After a few moments, Rafe's uncle emerged from the house, shadowed by a man roughly the same age. Unlike the others, this man was overweight and well-dressed. He wore Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses and a purple silk button-down shirt with short sleeves. A thick gold chain hung at his neck, and he sported what looked like crocodile skin loafers on his feet. His swollen fingers removed a half-smoked cigarette from his mouth, which he flicked aside before strolling slowly across the Hastings's veranda as if it were his own. Clearly, this man was the boss. The younger men perked up when he appeared, their confidence and aggressiveness boosted. He was the alpha, and they were the pack. He strode directly toward the white pickup with his gang falling in behind him. He ignored Rhys and walked to the driver's side window, saying something in Shona that Rhys couldn't understand. At Rafe's deliberate response in his native tongue, the fat man jerked a cocked and locked handgun from the back of his waistband. Rhys's dad had the same one in his collection, a Browning high-power 9mm. He held the muzzle to Rafe's head with his finger resting lazily on the trigger. Rhys glanced down at his rifle, knowing that he could never get to it in time. He had seldom felt so helpless in his life, and made up his mind that if Rafe were shot, his killer would die soon afterward. The man held the pistol for what seemed like an eternity, a gold bracelet dangling loosely from his sweaty wrist, the entire episode going into what felt like slow motion in Reese's mind. The tracker next to him murmured a hushed prayer, and Rhys found himself wondering what religion he followed. Rafe's uncle stood 10 yards away, unable to act against these armed tormentors. Finally, the man leaned in close to Rafe's face, an evil glimmer in his eye, before whispering, "Pow!" as he raised the muzzle in feigned recoil. He laughed a deep-throated laugh, his belly shaking against his expensive shirt, turning to face his men. They responded with laughs of their own, and those who carried weapons fired shots of intimidation into the clear blue sky. He motioned them toward their vehicles with his handgun, and they all crowded quickly aboard, one man holding the passenger door for the boss to drag his considerable bulk into the seat. The truck's wheels spun as they accelerated away, tearing deep red ruts into the lawn. Rich Hastings shook his head as he cursed the armed rabble.
"Bloody bastards!"
Rafe opened the truck door and walked to his uncle's side, seemingly unfazed by his own brush with death.
"Who in the hell were they, Uncle Rich?"
"Wovitz."
He pronounced it as a single word.
"Wovitz? Those guys look too young to have even been born when the war ended."
"That's just what they call themselves. They have nothing to do with the war. Mugabe and his people keep up the revolutionary rhetoric, so no one notices they're stealing the country blind. They're a gang of thieves, plain and simple, extortionists."
"What do they want?"
"Money, of course. Eventually they'll want the whole farm, but right now they'll settle for a payoff. I'd love to shoot the bastards, but that's what the government is hoping for. They send these gangs out to harass the landowners, knowing that if we fight back, they can run to the international media with cries of colonialism. Besides, if I fight back, the army would seize this place by nightfall."
"What about the police?"
Rhys chimed in, his American-born mind shocked at the injustice.
"The police? The police probably told them how to get here. Now, boys, there's not much we can do except pay their tribute and hang on as long as we can. I could move to the U.S. and go work for your father tomorrow, Rafe. But what would happen to this place? This farm has been in our family for 150 years. I'm not going to abandon it. We employ over 100 people here. You think those bastards are going to take care of them? We run our own school here, for Christ's sake."
As a 20-year-old, Rhys wasn't sure what to think, though he did recognize he was from a vastly different culture. On one hand, you had indigenous people who had elected a leader viewed by much of the world as legitimate, though there were already rumblings about the disappearances and murders of those who opposed the now entrenched dictator. On the other, you had the established property rights of families who had homesteaded their farms with the approval of the British Crown and lived on them legally for more than a century. Both sides believed that they were in the right, and neither was willing to budge. To the young American, it looked like conditions were ripe for war. Chapter 3. Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. Reese was on the backside of the storm now, the seas having calmed from deadly to merely rough. He powered up the GPS and took note of his location. The storm had pushed him quite a bit south, which was good news, so he decided to put up the sails to conserve fuel. With things more or less under control, Reese set the analog autopilot and went below for the first time in what felt like days. He looked in the mirror and couldn't help but laugh at the disheveled figure that returned his gaze. The gash on his forehead had stopped bleeding, but probably needed stitches. A few butterflies would have to do. Both eye sockets were swollen from the broken nose and were on their way to turning black. His hair was soaked and hung well below his collar. He washed his face in the sink, wrung his hair out, and stripped down so that he could put on dry clothes. He dug through the medical supplies and found what he was looking for: bandages and ibuprofen. Hunger hit next. His food stocks would, in all likelihood, outlive him, but he was already growing tired of frozen and canned food. Reese opened a Tupperware container of Oreos and stuffed two into his mouth for a quick sugar fix. He couldn't muster the energy to do any serious cooking, so he grabbed a bag of ramen noodles and nuked them in the microwave. Shoving a forkful of noodles down his throat was an action that he regretted instantly. The hot food seared the roof of his mouth, and he exhaled several quick breaths in an attempt to cool the scorching sustenance. He poked around the bowl with his fork, his exhausted brain debating between satisfying his hunger and the fear of burning his mouth again. Hunger won out, and he blew furiously on a second bite before placing it gingerly on his tongue. By the time the noodles had cooled to a palatable temperature, the bowl was empty. Reese drank some water and went back topside to give things a look. Satisfied that all was as it should be, he set the timer on his watch for 2 hours and fell face first onto the bed in the main stateroom. Reese was steering the boat on a calm sea as Lauren sunned herself on the deck, a precious moment of relaxation for the busy mother of a 3-year-old. He took in the increasingly rare family time with a smile, consciously aware of his happiness in the moment. Lucy sat on Reese's lap and helped steer, taking serious interest in the letters on the floating compass.
"S is for sissy,"
Lucy announced, referring to her pet name for her maternal grandmother. "That's right, pretty girl, you're so smart. What starts with an E?"
"Elmo."
"That's right, Lucy."
"What's that, Daddy?"
"What, baby?" Reese turned his head to see what his daughter was pointing at off the stern. A massive wave crested above the sailboat, as if in slow motion. Reese yelled for Lauren to hold on, but he couldn't make her hear him. The rogue wave crashed over the stern, swamping the boat and tearing Lucy from his grasp. She looked pleadingly into his eyes as she reached for his outstretched hand, the water dragging her ever farther away. He kicked his legs, but it was like running in wet concrete. Gasping for breath and redemption, with seawater filling his lungs, he descended into the depths, away from his family, away from life. A horrible beeping sound grew louder and louder, jolting Reese awake. He sat up, drenched in sweat, blinking his eyes and looking at the unfamiliar surroundings. It took him a few moments to get his bearings. He swung his feet to the floor and ran the fingers of both hands through his hair.
"It won't be long, girls.
I'll be with you soon. Maybe today. He fished around with his feet until they found his flip-flops. Then he stood and stretched until his hands hit the ceiling. He walked slowly through the galley and salon, grabbing his sunglasses from a table, before heading up to the deck to face his demons. Chapter 4. Al-Hasaka, Syria, November. Rojava, better known as the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, occupied the northwestern corner of the embattled nation. This multi-ethnic confederation had seceded from the central government with relative success and operated as an autonomous nation with its own constitution. After expelling ISIS, known there as Daesh, from the area, the local residents and refugees from the south enjoyed reasonable living conditions. In Rojava, equal rights for both genders, freedom of religion, and individual property rights were all enshrined in the founding document. These principles of secular democracy had united Arabs, Kurds, and Turks into relative peace and stability, and had the potential to spread across the rest of Syria. To most, this would seem to be good progress. To others, it was a threat to their power. The Interior Ministry of Syria had dispatched a sniper named Nizar Khatan to cut the head off the snake. The Federation and its nearly 5 million residents were led by co-presidents, an Arab, Masur Haddad, and a female Kurd, Hediye Fatah. Nizar was not a particularly devout Muslim, but he was an Arab and found the concept of a woman running a nation offensive. However, given the freedom to choose which of the co-presidents to target, Nizar decided upon the male. As much as he would love to teach this Kurd bitch a lesson, leaving a woman in charge would actually help unravel this little fiefdom even more. President Haddad's home sat in one of the better neighborhoods of Al-Hasaka, a large city that sat geographically near the nation's borders with both Turkey and Iraq. Hasaka was urban, crowded, and flat, making a long-range shot difficult to plan and execute. Though taking out the target at close range would make Nizar's escape more difficult, he'd planned for that contingency. He had examined the aerial photographs as well as the intelligence provided by regime assets operating in the city, but he could not locate an appropriate hide site. One of the older men in his unit mentioned a technique used by the DC snipers, a pair of criminals who had terrorized the American's capital city over a period of weeks just a year after 9/11. Nizar was too young to have remembered the attacks, but an online article gave him all the inspiration he needed to create his own rolling hide. The battered white Kia Frontier truck looked to be of similar vintage as most of the other vehicles parked on the street, and local plates had been secured so as not to arouse any suspicion from the Asayish, the local security forces. The truck's bed was piled with building materials covered by a plastic tarp and so looked like one of the many vehicles connected with a nearby construction site. Just after 9 o'clock p.m., Nizar pulled the truck up against the curb, with the bed facing the target's home. The street was deserted, but he went through the motions of pretending to look for something among the concrete blocks and lumber in the back of the truck, ultimately crawling into the hollow space he'd built and pulling a block into place behind him. He wasn't a tall man, but Nizar wished that the truck bed had been longer when he had to bend his knees to fit into the space. The night air was cool. He pulled up a woolen blanket, adding warmth and an additional layer of concealment to his prone form. Nizar had dozed off on a thin foam mattress but was jolted awake by the sensation of the truck's